Well, hello everyone. My name's Stuart Cross, and welcome to the teleseminar on rapid fire strategy, how to accelerate a compelling and a robust strategy for your business. This is a special teleseminar, as you know, and is available for free to anyone who's bought or acquired my new book, The CEO's Strategy Handbook. First, thank you for buying the book, and I hope you get some real value from it. And thank you for joining me today. And so whether you're on the phone listening live or whether you're listening to the MP3 recording, you're really very welcome, and it's great to have you. Now, as I wrote the book, I realized a couple of things. The first was that many businesses and many business strategies are relatively inflexible. Businesses find it difficult to adapt and to change course. And secondly, probably related to this, is that the process for developing and delivering strategy is often quite slow and quite bureaucratic. And I think one further thing is that the longer it takes to develop a new business strategy, the less likely, in my experience, that it will offer anything new or anything radical. It's as if the longer the process, the more chance managers have of talking themselves out of doing anything that's new or different. So, for example, in the past year or so, I've worked with a business where the strategy was developed and agreed in the space of 3 weeks or so, and another where it took probably 6 months. Now, the 2 week, 3 week strategy was a lot more focused, was more ambitious, and it had more management commitment, and it's led to more action on the ground than the 6 month strategy. Now, you don't need me to tell you that today's markets are uncertain, they're turbulent, and subject to rapid change. But in response to that, I think you need to be able to have a clear view about where you're heading and how you can best get there. You need to be both focused and flexible to make that happen. It's like if you're on a boat on the sea and there's an oncoming storm. You need to have a view as to where you're trying to get to. You need to know where your port is, where your destination is. But you're going to need to be flexible about how you skirt around the storm. You need to be flexible and change course appropriately. And that, to me, is what rapid-fire strategy is all about. It's that ability to be both focused and flexible. And over the next, 45 minutes probably or so, we're going to look at why companies find it difficult to develop and deliver strategy quickly. And I think what's required for them, for you, to do so. And we're going to do that. We'll look at five different areas. The first is, why is strategy so slow? The second is to say, what does a strategy look like? What does a good strategy look like? And we'll just kind of briefly go through that. The third thing we'll do is, how do you go about developing what I've called a rapid-fire strategy? The fourth thing we'll look at is all about implementation. Called it keeping your finger on the trigger, rapid fire strategy implementation. And the fifth thing, which I think underpins a lot of what we'll talk about today, is about building and sustaining an agile organization. But let's start with why strategy is so slow. And I have four reasons underpinning this. The first is that there is too much planning and too little strategy. And many executives, many of my clients, when they say they want a strategy, what they really mean is they want a plan. They want to know what they'll be doing next month, in 3 months' time, in 6 months' time. And, you know, plans are important. But a plan and a strategy are different things. A plan is all about allocating resources, and it allocates resources over a period of time to achieve a certain set of results. A strategy, on the other hand, is about setting a direction for the business. It starts to describe how you're going to win, how you're going to succeed. And it gives your managers and the organization a framework for making ongoing decisions and actions. So whilst a strategy and planning are related in some way, they are very different. And I find that the trouble in linking strategy with planning and in the planning process is that it leads to incrementalism, because in a planning process, one of the first things that happens is you set a sales target or a profit target. It becomes a budgeting exercise, and you're focused on how to grow by 3% or 4%, which starts to lead to a set of incremental initiatives to get there, rather than thinking about the fundamental direction of the organization and how you're going to win in the future. So to my mind, the term strategic planning is something of an oxymoron. There was a McKinsey survey, the consultants did a survey asking senior executives about the decisions they made during the strategic planning process. And fewer than 25% of the executives they talked to said that they made a big strategic decision within their strategic planning activities. You know, all the strategy was happening outside that process. The strategic planning is about budgeting. And when you try and link them together, the pace of strategy development is often glacial because you have to wait till the following year before you even have another discussion about it. To my mind, you need to separate out strategy from planning if you want to get some pace and want to get some focus into your business strategy and you want to accelerate your growth. So if you're planning, if you do your budgeting November, December time ahead of January, do your strategy work in the summer. Don't do it in October, November time, because then the pressure's on to get the budgets right. So that's number one, why strategy is slow. Excuse me. The second point is that there's often too much analysis and too few ideas. If you think about a business, they all start with an idea. FedEx started with the idea of guaranteed overnight parcel delivery. Ford started with the idea of a car for the normal man in the street. McDonald's started with the idea of convenient, good quality fast food. Your business started with an idea. But much of strategy work that I've been involved with starts with analysis. And it doesn't start with just a little analysis. It starts with a lot of analysis. And especially when you use consultants are experts at analysis. They have lots of people with laptops and spreadsheets, and they will analyze anything that moves, or particularly anything that doesn't move. So what you get is pages and pages of analysis, and the initial strategy sessions start going off to be detailed reviews of the market and what's happening, analyzing this, analyzing that. It doesn't start with discussing what the ideas about the business actually are. So too much analysis, too few ideas is number two. Number three, too much talking, too little action. I think there is a desire in many of us not to be wrong. We don't like to fail. But that can lead to excessive discussion. I was teaching at Nottingham University Business School earlier this week, and one of the students described the high-level strategy as a debating club. And in a way, he was right. I think there's a need for discussion. There's a need for dialogue. You need to get alignment. You need to get commitment. But you only really know whether your ideas are going to work when you take action. And Business Week did a survey of the top entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. And their number one reason they thought they were successful was their ability to experiment fearlessly. So they were willing to try new things, test them, fail, and try again. So to my mind, and we'll talk about this later, is how can you get to some level of action, not betting the organization, but some level of action so you can learn rather than doing too much talking. That's number three. And number four is too much reliance on consultants and too little management involvement. You know, as I've said, what are consultants good at? They're good at analysis. And the cliche is true. If you allow consultants to do your strategy work for you, you'll get a big, thick report. You'll get lots of great charts, lots of great tables, but you don't always get a whole lot of action. You know, I think, yes, use a consultant. I'm a consultant. Yes, please use a consultant, but use them to work with you as a partner, not as the provider of the answer, not as the expert. It's your job to develop the solution. Consultant can do that by asking good questions, helping you with the process, offering ideas, and keeping you honest with challenge along the way. But don't get them to develop the strategy for you, because I've yet to see that work in practice. So that's the first part that I want to talk through today. Why is strategy so slow? And we've said four reasons. Too much planning, too little strategy. Too much analysis, too few ideas. Too much talking, too little action. And fourthly, too much reliance on consultants and too little management involvement. And so if we go into the second area of today's session, before we get into how do we do strategy, rapid fire strategy, is what does a strategy look like? I would like us all to have the same view as to what we mean by the term strategy as it applies to your business. As I've said, in my mind, it's about setting a direction. You don't need to have dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, but a strategy should give you a framework for making those ongoing decisions, those ongoing actions that will enable your organization to win and succeed. It tells you what's important and what isn't. It tells you what you can and should focus on and what you shouldn't. And it'll tell you what you need to be famous for and what you don't. I write about this in the book, but there are four key elements to a strategy, and they form part of what I've called the strategy arrow. And I'll go through each of them in turn, so I think it's worth doing that. The first element of the strategy arrow, the very tip of the arrowhead, if you like, is your number one goal. Now, every business I have worked with has had lots of goals and lots of objectives. But which of them is the first among equals? And I think until you're clear on this, it's really hard to make headway. But once you're clear, everything else becomes easier. Many organizations have balanced scorecards, call them balanced scorecards. Balanced scorecards are great for reviewing progress, but I find them really poor for developing strategy. I think you need a single goal, a goal that rises above all the other objectives that you have. And in the book, Ian Silby, who's the CEO of DFS, the sofa business, wrote for me, he said, "One of the big strategy lessons I have learned as CEO of DFS is that a strategy has to meet a clear goal. Without agreement about the goal, you can't settle on your strategy." And, to my mind, he's absolutely right. And he and his team, they've settled on a profit goal for their business. But your goal doesn't need to be financial. If you look at BSkyB in the mid-2000s, they set themselves a goal. They had about 6 million subscribers. They set themselves the goal of growing to 10 million subscribers. So a big stretch. But that really drove a lot of their actions, you know, combining broadband and phone and TV, the whole HD move, generated the investment they made in sports and in football, generated more subscribers. Because they knew if they got more subscribers, that would drive their financial model. And again, coming from the book, Stephen Ford, who runs Avon business, the cosmetics business in Australia and New Zealand, he wrote this. He said, "I cannot let the strategy be seen as an abstract idea that has no relevance to everyone's day-to-day activities. Otherwise, it will die. Consequently, my first strategic decision was to set a clear stretching performance goal for the business. Having looked at various options with my executive team, we settled on a goal of receiving 1 million customer orders. We chose this goal because, all things being equal, growing orders will drive our profitability. But we also used this goal as it's memorable. Everyone can remember the 1 million orders target." So as I say, in some ways, this is the opposite of a balanced scorecard where all objectives are equal. This is about making choices about what's really important and about your level of ambition. You need other KPIs to manage performance along the way and making sure you're delivering your goal in the right way. But you really need a clear view about what's really important. That, to my mind, is job one of strategy, your number one goal. The second element of the strategy arrow, if you like, kind of just supporting the arrowhead, is where you play. And this sets out the scope of your business, both currently and where you want it to be in the future. And there are four elements to this. There are your priority target customers, They are the products and services you offer them. The thirdly is the channels by which you reach your customers. And fourthly is your geographical reach. So kind of sounds simple. Who are your customers? What are your products? How do you reach your customers? And what's your geographical spread? But many leadership teams aren't clear about, firstly, who their current priority customers are, or, for example, what channels or what products they want to be focused on, say, in 2 or 3 years' time. So really understanding the scope of your business both now and where you want to take it in the future can make a huge difference to your performance. So ask yourself, what is your playing field? Where do you play now and where do you wish to play in the future? The third element of the strategy arrow, again supporting the very arrowhead, if you like, is how you win. And this is all about what you will be famous for and how you're going to be advantaged in your market. And generically, I think there are 5 different types of market leader. And let me just briefly go through them. The first is to be a product leader. So you could be like Apple or Nike or BMW. You have the very best products or the latest products. You have leading edge products on the market. And your customers will say, you know, it costs more, but it's worth it. New product development is critical to you if you are a product leader. The second kind of leadership is very different to that. It's about being a cost leader. And cost leaders, customers will say, you know, I cannot believe the price. I can't believe the value. So Aldi, as a retailer, is a cost leader. Ryanair is a cost leader. It's all about minimizing costs for these organizations. So kind of Aldi and Lidl don't necessarily, the cashiers in those stores have to memorize all the prices because they don't want to invest in the systems. The third type of leader is to be a convenience leader. McDonald's, Amazon, Dell, these are all convenience leaders where customers say it's all so hassle-free. It's all about convenience, it's about reliability, it's about great value. The fourth type of leadership is to be a service leader. Again, very different. Service leaders such as John Lewis in the UK or Singapore Airlines are all about having really effective frontline teams who can give your customers a great experience every time. It's about their friendliness, their expertise, their knowledge, and their way that they can impart that to your customers. Service leader is the fourth type of market leader. And the fifth type is what I call a solutions leader. So the likes of IBM and McKinsey as a consultant are a solutions leader. These companies give each customer and each client bespoke, customized solutions. And your customers and clients will say, that's exactly what I needed. And again, the real skill and the capability of solutions leaders is having frontline teams who are able to build great relationships, deep relationships with their customers, so they almost know their clients better than the clients know themselves, and are able to create solutions that meet a broader set of needs. Critically, across these 5 different types of leader, product, cost, convenience, service, and solutions, it's difficult to be a leader on any one dimension. It's almost impossible to really lead on more than one. So again, in this process, the key thing is to choose, because if you're not leading, you're going to be lost in the crowd and you're going to be competing on price. So ask yourself, where are you now on each of these 5 dimensions? Are you at least competitive, or are you leading your market? And where do you wish to be on each of these 5 dimensions in the future? In the book, I've given you a template to map yourself and your competitors. And I found working with my clients, it's a really quick and effective way to really understand the opportunities for leadership in your market and in creating a really good discussion amongst the leadership team about your future direction. And then lastly, the fourth element of the strategy arrow is the agenda for action. And this is almost kind of the shaft of the arrow. It keeps it straight. It keeps it in flight. And these are the handful of key objectives that will get you from where you are now to your strategic future and achieving your number one goal. And whilst the objectives will remain probably relatively consistent over a period of time, the projects beneath them will probably change year to year. So, for example, Tesco had for about a decade, they focused on four simple objectives. And it was something like the first one was a strong UK business. The second was to become a serious international player. The third was to become as big in non-food as they were in food. And the fourth was to create new retailing services, such as Tesco.com and Tesco Mobile. So they set themselves up these four objectives, and they consistently pursued these objectives year on year with a stream of different initiatives. That kind of consistency gave the organization real focus. People knew what was important. So again, for you, what are your 3 to 6 objectives that you run your business on? What's really important to you? Now, as we're going to see next, developing these four elements of the strategy arrow needn't take too long. But once you've agreed them, it can really help accelerate the implementation of your strategy and the delivery of new growth. Because you have clarity on your ambition, you know how you're going to win, and you know what your priorities are. And that makes it much easier. Makes it much easier for your managers and colleagues to make things happen. And if you're the leader of your business, it also makes it easier for you to hold your people to account. So, you know, as we've gone through them, how many of those four elements of the strategy arrow, the number one goal, where you play, how you win, and your agenda for action, how many of those four elements are in place in your business? So that's part two, what a strategy actually is. Part three of today's session is all about how do you develop a rapid-fire strategy. So I guess this is the meat of today's session. And typically, a strategy process takes 3 months, maybe more, to develop. And as I've said already, it starts with lots of research and analysis. You know, it looks at past performance. It looks at market conditions, customer research, operational reviews. I believe you can get there in a space of 2 to 4 weeks. You can, of course, you can do it in a day if you want, but I'm talking about having some time for reflection, for discussion, for iteration and refinement of your strategy. And in the book, Jeremy Ling, the CEO of Bristan, a UK-based taps and showers manufacturer, he talks about involving his people and the importance of that. And I actually worked with Jeremy and his top 40 managers. So we're 40 of us in the room to develop the strategy. And we did it in less than a month. So let me just go through what we did to show you how you can bring your strategy alive within the space of 2 to 4 weeks. There were four key stages. The first was some initial pre-work. So this wasn't huge analysis, but it was just some key facts covering financial performance, an assessment of the key markets the business was in, a summary of what customers thought of the business and thought of the business's competitors, and a view on the organization's overall health, you know, what the talent was like, staff satisfaction, key capabilities and the key assets of the organization. But we didn't start there when we started the work, but it was there to refer to. It was circulated ahead of it. We didn't have a session on the analysis, but it was there if we needed it. We started with a 2-day session with the 40 managers, and we looked at the strategy arrow. And the first thing we did was we immediately developed an answer for the business. In fact, we ended up developing a couple of answers. So why start a strategy process with the answer rather than an assessment? I have three reasons why I, over time, have decided to do this. The first is that it's quicker. You know, you as a manager know your business, and you already have ideas about how you should take it forward. So why not get them on the table immediately? And it's the same in other businesses. People know their business. Let's get those ideas out, and then we can start to talk about them. The second reason is it promotes involvement and engagement. if you're listening to reports on analysis or listening to presentations, PowerPoints, that's passive. Sharing your views is active. And so the process of starting with the answer gets everybody immediately involved and engaged in the process. And thirdly, in my experience, you get a clearer, you get a better solution overall. I find that too much analysis gets you lost, and focusing on the solution starts to generate clarity because it creates debate and you realize what are the really important issues quite quickly. And what we found was, even in this initial session with 40 senior and middle managers, the business started to take some big decisions. And Jeremy writes in the book, he says, "I have learned that middle managers are very willing and able to face into our company's biggest, most challenging issues. They came up with creative, value-added solutions that challenged the thinking of our executive team." So at the end of that initial 2 days, we had an outline strategy arrow, some assumptions that supported the reasons for the emerging strategy, and some further questions. And the team then took about a week or so, probably 10 days, to do some initial follow-up work, answer the questions, and follow up on any concerns. But about 10 days later, we came back for the second session, and the second session was focused on developing agenda, and that's the third stage in the process, developing the agenda. And this session also lasted a couple of days, but it was about bringing the strategy down to earth, and we did three things over these two days. We went back and looked at the work that came out of the first session. We reviewed it, we refined it, and we confirmed and updated the strategy arrow. The second thing we did was to start to describe and articulate the future organization that will be required to deliver the strategy. What kind of size of organization? What kind of roles would be important? What capabilities were required? What talent was going to be required to be able to pull this off? What would be the key processes of the organization? What did it have to get right? That started to make things more concrete, more real. And we also built an outline route map, a high-level plan of key milestones and performance improvement for the next, it covered 3 years, but we split it between 6 months, 12 months, 2 years and 3 years. About how the company was going to deliver the strategy and achieve its goals. And then finally, within that route map, senior executives were given accountability for one or more of the key objectives set out in the agenda for action. So by now, about 2 weeks after the kickoff session, we had a clear view as to what the company was trying to achieve, its level of ambition, and starting to get a view about how it would go about achieving its objectives. And we also had names in the frames for who would be leading those key initiatives and activities. We didn't have all the detailed answers about exactly what was going to happen, but we had a view of how we could make progress and move forward. And that led on to the fourth stage, the final stage of developing this rapid-fire strategy. And that was to create an initial plan covering the first 6 months in some detail, and slightly higher level for the following 6 months. Critically, the high-level goals were embodied. Embedded in everyone's performance contract. And as Jeremy says, this is what is written in the book. He says, "Every one of our 700 employees has a performance contract that is shaped directly by their specific contribution to their division's strategic agenda. Their job descriptions, performance objectives, and bonus criteria reflect their own division's KPIs and their involvement in its strategic projects. That way, we ensure that we align our corporate goals with individual objectives, and the subsequent performance review conversations provide a feedback loop on the effectiveness of our strategy, allowing us to continue to improve it as we go along." So there you are. A grounded, compelling growth strategy and a plan in less than 4 weeks. Just place in the oven at 200 degrees C, gas mark 4, Bob's your uncle. Now, Bristan is about a £100 million business, but I believe that a similar approach can be used for much larger organisations as well as smaller ones. critical in here is your willingness to use your judgment about what the solution is, to use your belief in your own judgment about what on some of the initial choices as you start to develop your strategy arrow, and not relying on detailed analysis to get there. I've been running a recent project, and we've had a 4-week, probably we've delayed ourselves 4 weeks because we wanted to do extra analysis. The team wanted to do extra analysis on which of a various set of options about where to grow would be the right set of options. And actually, what I should have done is ask the people in the room there and then which ones they thought would be the best way forward. And I bet that they would all have come up with the same answer. We've got to get people to use their judgment. But that is part three of today's session, developing a rapid-fire strategy. 4 sections to it. This is what we did with Bristan. We did some initial pre-work. We had a 2-day session on the strategy arrow. We had a 2-day session a week or so later on developing the agenda. And then specific directors and their teams built a plan with individual-level accountabilities. Part 4 today I've called Keeping Your Finger on the Trigger, Implementing a Rapid-Fire Strategy. And in this part of the session, I want to cover 3 things. First is that pace is not the same as haste. Second is don't get lost in translation. And third is to give you a few simple management processes for managing implementation of strategy. So let's start with pace is not the same as haste, or kind of less haste, more speed. I think there are 3 key elements to driving pace in organizations rather than creating haste. The first of these is effective prioritization. When you come up with a new growth strategy, you'll come up with loads of ideas about how you can actually grow the business and what you could do. And I think one of the hardest, toughest management tasks, but a critical one, is to prioritize, is to sort out which ones you should be focusing on and which ones you should be putting on the back burner. About a year or so ago, I had a meeting with a CEO of a quite big company, and he was telling me that he had 27 priorities that the company were pursuing. So I asked him, I didn't ask him to be clever, I just asked him what were they. But he couldn't actually name more than, he didn't get to 10, he probably named 7 or 8 of the priorities. If you can't even name your priorities, you haven't really got a good chance of delivering them. You know, think about it. If you've got 27 priorities or you've got 1 priority, which one will you make more progress on? A wise man once said to me, it's better to move 3 things a mile than 100 things an inch. And you have to make some choices to be able to do that. One way you can do it, and one way I work with my clients to do this, is to think about phasing. It's not saying we're not going to do something, it's just saying we're not going to do it now. For example, I've been working with a grocer recently on a new growth strategy, and we've created 3 phases. So the first phase is all about putting in place the right growth foundations, kind of fixing the basics, if you like. The second is implementing different and better customer offer. And the third is delivering new possibilities. So the first phase is all about just getting what they do already working properly, then enhancing the offer, and then starting to think even more broadly about extra possibilities and new directions for the business. But critically, we've put them into phases. The focus is on phase 1. There's still some development work happening on phase 2. We have to start the development work on some of those projects now. And there's still a bit of thinking about phase 3, but probably there'll be kind of 80% of the effort, maybe more, is on phase 1. 15%, if you like, is on phase 2. 5% is on phase 3. By phasing it, we've been able to create some focus and some prioritization. So that's the first element in terms of driving pace rather than haste. The second is to separate objectives from tactics. Jeff Bezos, who's the CEO of Amazon, once said that we are fixed on the goal, flexible on the journey, fixed on the vision, flexible on the journey. And that's where I came in at the start of this session, really. And that, to me, is the recipe for success for rapid fire strategy, knowing what you want to achieve, but being flexible about how you achieve it. My wife and I, kind of many years ago, probably a lifetime ago, were going on a driving holiday to France, and we lived in Newcastle at the time. And we woke up to go on our holiday. I went down onto the street to collect the car, and there was just an empty gap in the road where I had left my car the night before. Someone had stolen our car. Now, after my wife kind of cried down the phone at 6 o'clock in the morning to one of my friends, we were able to borrow his car, but that meant we had to change all of the insurance. So as we were driving down to Dover, we were faxing, because this was the days before mobile phones, we were faxing from little chef cafes to the insurer to try and get the insurance documents. And we then went through the City of London to the insurer's headquarters to pick up the insurance documents to be able to drive to Dover and to get the ferry. Now, in the end, we're only about an hour late. We're only about an hour behind schedule. But it's all about, we were fixed, we had a clear objective of what we wanted to do going on holiday, and we had to be flexible on the journey because stuff happens. And one of my favourite examples in the book that I wrote is that of Tesco Express. And Tesco Express, amazingly, it took Tesco about 5 years to get from the initial idea of Tesco Express to actually having a model, a format, that delivered the right levels of return for them and delivered the customer experience they wanted that enabled them to really roll it out. After 5 years, they still only had something like 17 stores on the ground. But they, because they had separated objectives from tactics, their objective was to get into the convenience supermarket channel. They wanted to be big in convenience. They were persistent and they were flexible and they tried different ways to work out the best way to make that happen. And it took them 5 years. Most companies give up on something after a year or so. But when you're fixed on your objective, fixed on the vision, and willing to be flexible on the journey, that also helps you to be persistent. And the third element, in terms of pace is not the same as haste, and driving pace rather than haste, is being able to learn rapidly. Because one thing's for sure, most of the initiatives in delivering your new growth agenda they require you to do something new. And so they're not going to work first time. So you need to test and trial and iterate as you go. And the faster you can do that and the cheaper you can do that, the better. And it really requires a focus on action, not planning. You know, early in the session I said, problem with strategy is too much planning, too much talking, too little action. What you really require is rapid learning, and that requires action. And in the book, I quoted Michael Bloomberg, who's the mayor of New York, but is also the founder and owner of Bloomberg Communications. And he said in his book, Bloomberg by Bloomberg, he said, "We made mistakes, of course. Most of them were omissions we didn't think of when we initially wrote the software. We fix them by doing it over and over, again and again. We do the same today. While our competitors are still sucking their thumbs, trying to make the design perfect, we're already on prototype version number 5. By the time our rivals are ready with wires and screws, we're on version number 10. It gets back to planning versus acting. We act from day one. Others plan how to plan for months." The quicker you can get to some level of action, I'll talk of this about a little more in a couple of minutes, the quicker you can get there, the more rapidly you are going to grow. The second element in pace is not the same as haste is the importance of not getting lost in translation. And people often ask me whether strategies fail in development or fail in implementation. And in my view, it's neither. Most strategies fail in the gap between development and implementation. Strategies fail in their translation. And Hugo Reisner, who is an ex-CEO of a big fashion label in Germany, a 750 million euro fashion label in Germany, he wrote in the book after I interviewed him, he said, "By training, I am an architect. Between an architect and the craftsman who will build the final structure that the architect designs is the building contractor. The building contractor, or Baumeister in German, has a pivotal role to play. In particular, he works out the best way to realize the architect's vision on the ground. This means that while he has to understand and appreciate the architect's vision and concept, he must also be able to relate to and communicate with the specialist who will actually build the structure. It's the same with strategy. There is a key role for someone to work with the agreed ideas and work out how they can best be delivered." Now, I really agree with Hugo. You need someone in the organization who can translate the high-level strategy into something that can be delivered on the ground, which I call ground-level strategy. But I'd go a bit further. I think there's a real stage in the strategy process when you need to create the conditions in the organization for effective implementation. And these conditions, there are seven of them that I've identified. The first is effective prioritization and phasing of the work, which is what we've already discussed. The second, probably comes before that, is genuine alignment across the leadership team about the new strategy, the new agenda, the new goal. You need a 100% alignment. Footballers would say you need 150% alignment. But if you can get that, even better. It's absolutely critical because people can spot any differences in opinion between two executives from at least a mile. The third thing that you need is great communication about what the strategy is and why it's important. And that's not just kind of one-off big showcase events, but it's about the small everyday conversations and meetings you have with your people right across the business. Now, when I worked at Boots, Richard Baker for a while was the chief executive, and he was superb at communicating with people, but also explaining the importance of the strategy, not just in the boardroom, but when he was talking to people in Boots stores as well. And I have the view that you need to think about communicating your strategy 6,000 times. So if you think about a strategy, say, lasting 3 years, and you have 200 working days a year, and you have 10 meetings a day, if you multiply those together, that works out at 6,000 opportunities to articulate the strategy. And I think that's what you have to do. Number four is about resource allocation. It's about changing the way you invest in your business. You need to be willing to change the way you allocate resources. If you're not able to do that, chances are the strategy will not happen. Similarly, number five is talent deployment. Just as you need to allocate your scarce cash, you also need to allocate your scarce talent. Number six is about setting individual accountabilities. People need to know what they're accountable for. As Jeremy did at Bristan. And number seven is agreeing a set of company-wide key performance indicators that support delivery of the strategy. So ask yourself, for each of these elements, these seven elements, how well does your organization score? Let's go through a quick test, and I'd like you to give yourself marks out of 10 for each of these, where 10 is fully implemented in your business, and naught is it hasn't happened at all in your business. So rate yourself here. How do you rate yourself for one? You have prioritized and phased the key initiatives to deliver your strategy. Give yourself a mark out of 10 for that. You have prioritized and phased the key initiatives to deliver your strategy. The second is that the leadership team is completely and fully aligned on your number one goal, your strategy, and your agenda. What's the score out of 10 in your business for that? The leadership team is completely aligned on your number one goal, your strategy, and your agenda. Number three, you relate every decision and every action you make to your underlying strategy. So when you're communicating, you're talking about the strategy every time, and each decision and each action is related to that. Number four, you have reallocated your scarce resources to reflect your new strategic ambitions. Again, score out of 10. Number five, your top talent is leading the most important strategic initiatives and objectives. Number six, everyone in the organization has a set of accountabilities that relate directly to your strategic objectives and your agenda. And number seven, your KPIs, on which you focus your performance management, have been changed to reflect your new strategic priorities. So again, how many out of 10 for that statement? What is that true in your business? Personally, I think you need to be at 8 or more out of 10 on each of these dimensions, each of them, if you're going to have a realistic chance of effective implementation and if you're to avoid getting lost in translation. And if you've got any areas there where you're scoring, say, 5 or less, I think you need immediate attention. Really important, don't get lost in translation. That's where strategies fail. And the third part of just this section about keeping your finger on the trigger and implementing a rapid-fire strategy is about just sharing a simple rapid-fire implementation process. And probably the best way of doing this is to briefly share how I've worked with a couple of my clients over the past few months to create what's hopefully a simple but focused way of managing their implementation. And there are basically 5 elements to this process. And they are these. The first is that each project creates an 18-month implementation plan. And that plan has milestones and performance goals. It's not a detailed Gantt chart. It's about milestones. What will be delivered by what date? And the 18 months are split into 4 sections. So the first section is the first 3 months, split into what will be achieved by each month. The second is what you're going to deliver between 3 and 6 months. The third is what you'll deliver between 6 and 12 months. And the fourth is what you'll deliver between 12 and 18 months. So what you have is more detailed focus on your initial 3 months, the next 3 months, than 18 months' time. Now, when I've done this with my clients, and some of them have been big businesses, you can get this onto a page per project. It's not about excessive detail. It's a management tool to make sure things are happening. But that's the first element to the process. The second element is you have quarterly updates of these plans with a clear focus on what will be delivered over the next 90 days. I think doing an annual plan, never mind a 3-year plan, given the state of turbulence and the dynamism in most markets, you need to have a view as to where each of the projects are going. But focus on doing something really clear in the next 3 months. So you need these quarterly updates of the plan. The third element is that there are monthly reviews of progress against the plan. So you're saying, and people are being held to account on delivery of both the milestones and the KPIs, and they're having to report back on them. The fourth element to the process is that they are, in both the organizations I've worked with, they are CEO-led sessions. It's about the CEO and his executive leadership team. Because that drives accountability. It drives ownership, and it shows the importance of it. So the quarterly update of the plan, the initial planning, the quarterly update, and the monthly reviews are all led by the CEO in probably, it takes about 2 hours per month, maybe an afternoon per month, to actually make this happen, depending on how many projects you're running. The fifth element is that all projects must have an end date. In my experience, too many projects go on too long. The plan must include an end date and a clear understanding of how the ongoing issues will be passed over to the line and the operations team. So that's part 4, keeping your finger on the trigger, implementing a rapid-fire strategy. And we said there that pace is not the same as haste, the importance of not getting lost in translation, and I shared with you a simple rapid-fire implementation process of how you can manage implementation. Part 5, and the final part today, is about building and sustaining an agile organization. And if we think about the theme, pace and rapid-fire strategies, they demand agile organizations. You're not going to be able to achieve this with a stiff bureaucratic organization. And I'm going to leave you today with six ways to create agility. The first is that agility requires stretching. Now, my wife is more agile than I am. Some of you who know me will not be surprised to hear that. But she does a lot of yoga. She does stretching exercises. And these stretching exercises help her to be more agile. And I think organizations are the same. They also need to stretch and be stretched regularly in order to be agile. And that's why I find that agility and the ability to change direction, the ability to change course, is often better in companies that have a little bit of chaos in them, hopefully it's organized chaos, but they tend to feel more chaotic than in very ordered businesses. Ordered organizations, to my mind, are just too stiff to be agile. So I was at a client's earlier this week, a really, you know, a good company and a fairly agile company. And my specific client is a buying director for the business. But she also has responsibility for one of the priority customer groups. So for her, this creates stretch. She has dual responsibilities. She has to work out what's really important to get both jobs done. So she has to focus on the important stuff and either delegate or defer the rest of the stuff. And that, to my mind, is critical. She feels stretched all the time. Because she's stretched all the time, she's actually able to make these ongoing decisions and she's used to changing course. She has that agility. And if you have that across the organization, then the whole organization becomes agile. The second element for creating an agile organization, I think, is about involvement and commitment. So we've already talked about Jeremy Ling at Bristol involving 40 managers in the development of strategy. But I also, in the book, talked to a guy called Dennis Sedlowski, who ran the Siemens energy business in the USA. And what he wrote in the book was this. He said, engagement starts with involvement, and I ensure that the executive team and key managers at the next level in the organization were intimately involved in the development of our growth strategy. We didn't rely on external consultants to tell us the way forward. We led the work ourselves, doing our own blocking and tackling to ensure we understood the detail. You know, agile organizations, they're not created through diktat or coercion or telling people what to do. They're created when everyone buys into the direction, feels a part of the organization, and they feel able and they're willing to make their own decisions to find the best way to achieve the company's shared goals. Involvement and commitment are critical to agility. Third element is an ability to jump on the big wins. I think serendipity, a bit of happy fortune, plays a part in any company's success. But you also have to be watching out for the opportunity. You can't just be head down delivering the plan. If a new opportunity arises or a new success arises, you need to be able to jump on it. That's what Apple did. You know, that Apple's success in the over the last 10 or 15 years started with iTunes and the iPod. Started with music, not with the computer business. But they were able to jump on that success and really drive huge growth and momentum. In a smaller way, Boots, my old alma mater, had a huge success with its number 7 Protect and Perfect skin cream. But it was able then, following that success, it has really developed that brand further, driven its growth, and really exploited it in a good way. But that requires a focus and a willingness to shift gears rapidly, deprioritize some stuff, in order to get more out of what's really working. Jumping on the big wins is number 3. Number 4 is having a simple organization. Now, the world is getting increasingly complex, and my view is that the solution isn't for your organization to try and match that complexity and become really complex yourselves, but for you to be as simple, keep your organization as simple as you possibly can. And whenever you have a new organizational change and improvement opportunity, I would always err on the side of simplicity. It's really Occam's razor. I don't know if you've heard of the term Occam's razor, but he was a 13th century philosopher who said something along the lines of, if you're faced with two choices, about the best way forward, chances are the simplest one is the best one. And, you know, that's still true 700 or whatever it is years on from when he first said that. Erring on the side of simplicity in your organisation. Number five is to be experts in the art of prototyping. So whatever new growth ideas you come up with, one thing you can be sure of is that the first iteration won't work. And that's why being able to build, test and improve versions of your ideas is so important. And we've already heard Michael Bloomberg's quote about action and prototyping driving both pace and driving performance. And number six, the final one here, I think is about becoming expert at managing and being involved in partnerships, being an expert at partnerships. I'm increasingly convinced that partnerships are the best route to sustainable growth. You know, in a world that is fast-paced, uncertain, chaotic, turbulent, partnerships allow you to work at greater pace, develop new capabilities in a way that lowers your risk. And even in today's Financial Times, I was reading today that BMW and Toyota have announced a partnership where BMW will supply Toyota with engines for a new range of cars and decided to partner on it. These are two competitors working together, collaborating in an area of their business, because it allows them both to grow and it allows them both to lower risk in an uncertain world. They don't need to invest all of the capital. I think partnerships are increasingly important, and I intend to kind of write and speak more about partnerships over the next 12 months. But you need certain skills to be able to partner effectively. You need those relationship building skills, having ways of working across businesses, being able to set and manage objectives. These things are all really critical, and they're not necessarily the natural ways that traditional organizations work. So those are the six areas, the final part of today, about building and sustaining an agile organization. First is that agility requires stretch. Second is the importance of involvement and commitment. Third is jumping on the big wins. The fourth is having a simple organization. Number five was becoming expert in the art of prototyping. And number six was becoming expert at partnerships. So in today's session, I've shared with you ways to develop strategies both more effectively and more rapidly. And I've tried to give you ways to turn those strategies into initiatives the organization can deliver, and ways to accelerate delivery and growth for your business. In my own view, creating and delivering a new strategy for your business is probably one of the most enjoyable, most rewarding, satisfying things any business leader can do. But it's not easy. It's not easy, but it's less difficult than many academics and consultants would have you believe. It's less about intellect, and it's more about courage, a belief in your judgment and leadership. I think in times like this, we need more businesses with a clear view as to how they can lead in their markets and how they can drive new growth. So I wish you all the very best in developing and delivering a rapid-fire strategy for your business and in rapidly accelerating your own growth and performance. Thank you for joining me today. Have a great day. Goodbye.